memory.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Dan Novak, Gregory Stockel, and Jill Robbins. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Dan Novak.
A group of global investors is urging the European Commission not to consider industrial farming an activity that is good for the environment. Reuters reported the request last week. It said the international group of companies that wrote the letter to the Commission is together worth more than $3.5 trillion. The European Commission is close to defining what activities the European Union considers sustainable. The EU hopes the move will get businesses to help it lower emissions of carbon gases linked to climate change, also called greenhouse gases. It has been difficult, however, to reach political agreement on what activities to include in the EU taxonomy. Taxonomy is a word describing a process of placing things in groups based on their qualities. Farming is responsible for around 10% of the EU's carbon gas emissions. But how to deal with farming in EU rules has been a disputed issue because the industry is so important and employs many people. Countries and trade groups also have an interest in continued government support for the nuclear energy, gas, and farming industries. The investor group wrote to Commission President Ursula von der Leyen on October 5th. The group said it was making its position public after a report sent to EU governments proposed that a large amount of agricultural subsidies should be considered sustainable or green. The investor's letter also said farm animals raised on industrial farms have bad effects on biodiversity, water, resistance to bacteria, and soil health. It is critical that the EU taxonomy only defines as green those sectors that are genuinely environmentally sustainable, said Helena Wright. She is with the FAIR Initiative, the investor group that led the effort to write the letter to the Commission. It is deeply concerning to see a proposal that would count EU agricultural subsidies as green when we know that many of these subsidies are harmful, she said. Other groups that signed the letter include Britain's Financial Business, Legal and General Investment Management, Aviva Investors, and Norway's Storebrand. The letter was released one day after the European Parliament approved reforms to farming subsidies under the Common Agricultural Policy, known as CAP. The reforms give more money to smaller farmers that use sustainable methods. Under the new rules, at least 10% of CAP money will go to smaller farms. All farm payments would be tied to following environmental rules. Naming intensive farming subsidies green risks weakening the EU's climate goals, Wright said. Alexander Burr is head of environmental policy issues at Legal and General Investment Management. He said the EU's decisions need to be based in science. Burr said they must support reducing emissions and that agriculture is a key but often overlooked sector. I'm Dan Novak. We'll be right back.
A new report warns that Australia's native wildlife could see disastrous effects from non-native plants and animals. Experts at the National Science Agency, the CSIRO, are predicting much of the country's native plants and animals are in danger. They believe they could disappear by 2050 unless urgent action is taken. Non-native species have invaded Australia and threaten to overrun native plants and animals. Invasive animals include European rabbits, which overrun two-thirds of Australia, wild house cats, pigs, and foxes. Introduced species are endangering more than 80% of Australia's threatened species. The report is called Fighting Plagues and Predators, Australia's Path Towards a Pest and Weed-Free Future. It notes what researchers believe is an upcoming wave of new extinctions. The study was done by the Commonwealth Scientific and Industrial Research Organization, or CSIRO, a government agency. Andy Shepherd is CSIRO's research director for biosecurity. He said Australia's colonization by the British more than 200 years ago has left harmful environmental effects. Look, Australia as a lot of post-British colonial countries suffered from a huge amount of introduction of exotic species early in their colonization histories, he said. He added that there were groups set up to purposefully introduce plants and animals, so the Europeans felt more at home. Australia, just like New Zealand, has suffered as a result. Australia, unfortunately, has the worst record internationally for mammalian extinction, he said, and noted that this has much to do with the activities of introduced cats and foxes. I'm Gregory Stockel.
Have you ever seen an advertisement for a language immersion program? These programs can take place in a school or other location where a learner can practice using their second language in a natural setting. The language immersion situation forces the learner to use the new language throughout the day. They must try to communicate their ideas and understand native speakers. Speaking and hearing others use the language at meals, while shopping, or taking part in other activities gives language learners valuable and enjoyable practice. The use of new technologies can help you create your own immersion experiences. Below are some details on how you can plan an English immersion program for yourself and carry it out in your own home. Follow these basic guidelines in making your program. Make a plan. How long will you do the immersion? Plan your time so that you will get some practice every day during the period of time you choose. For example, you may decide that for the next week, you will speak only English after 6 p.m. or listen to English news every morning at 7 o'clock. Look for chances to get both passive and active language practice. Passive language use is listening or reading, while active language use involves speaking or writing. Measure your progress with tests and give yourself prizes or treats when you meet goals. Step 1. Know your starting level. It is best to know your ability level to create your immersion program. You can test yourself with a free online language test, like the FSET test. After a period of time, you can take the same test again and see how much you improved. Knowing your level also lets you choose materials at the right level. The VOA English Challenge test on our website will give you a score on the Council of Europe's CEFR scale. That goes from A1 to C2. Step 2. Choose materials a little above your level. Immersion programs often include material that is at a little higher level than the material you normally use. On our website, for example, there are 3 levels: beginner, intermediate, and advanced. If you have been reading at the intermediate level for some time, try choosing readings from our advanced level, such as American Stories. Here are some ideas on how to find materials to help you practice the 4 language skills in English. Here are some ideas for reading and vocabulary. Change your social media language to English. Follow English speakers and make comments in English. Subscribe to daily news updates in English, like our newsletter, or a national news service in your country, or an English-speaking country you want to learn more about. Cooking something new? Find a recipe in English to follow. Or watch a cooking video online in English. Read children's stories in English to your own or a friend's child. Put small signs around your house with the name of common objects in English. After you learn the words, you can act like a broadcaster who is telling about your movements through your house. She is walking through the living room now. Now she is in the kitchen. She is picking up a cup. Here are some ideas for listening materials. Listen to our daily podcast. You can read the stories after you listen on our homepage. Use TuneIn or other podcast services to subscribe to English podcasts. Listen to English-speaking artists performing your favorite style of music. Often these are available with subtitles on YouTube. Sing along if you like hearing yourself sing. Watch English movies and television programs on a streaming service. Turn off the subtitles to make it harder. Later, go back and watch again with the subtitles turned on if you need them. Here are some ideas for speaking. Join conversation clubs on the internet or in person, such as Clubhouse, Meetup, or The Mixer. Learn more in our article, 5 Tips for Great Language Exchanges. Talk with yourself in English. This may feel strange at first. However, the more you do it, the more you will begin to think in English, which is a big step toward becoming fluent. If you have a pet animal, speak to it in English. Join a speech-making group or class, such as Toastmasters. Play online games in English. Having fun while you learn makes it much easier to remember what you are learning. One game service, especially for language learners, is InFluent. Here are some ideas for writing. Write your to-do list or marketing list in English. Keep a diary or daily journal in English. Writing about your own experiences will help you learn words important to your life. Write comments in blogs and on social media in English. You can also write comments on our stories, of course. Step 3. Change up your practice. On some days, put more of your effort toward reading and writing. On others, spend more time on listening and speaking. Try to avoid doing the same thing each day. And take a break now and then to rest your brain. Read our story on spacing and interleaving your learning for more on this topic. Step 4. Make new friends and have fun. Through conversation clubs and the new activities that are part of your language immersion, you will probably find new friends. Speak English with them as often as you can. Look for ways to make your immersion program fun, like inviting a friend or family member to join you. I'm Jill Robbins.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. In the spring of 1865, the American Civil War was over, and the president who had led the Union during that war was dead. Abraham Lincoln had been murdered before the final surrender of Confederate forces. Now, the reunited nation had a new president, Andrew Johnson. He had been Lincoln's vice president. The Chief Justice of the United States swore Johnson into office a few hours after Lincoln's death. Most of Lincoln's cabinet was there, together with leading members of Congress. They looked to the new president with a mixture of shock and hope. Shep O'Neill and Tony Riggs begin the story of America's 17th president.
Andrew Johnson was, like Abraham Lincoln, a man of the people. He was born in North Carolina. His family was poor. There was no money or time for young Andrew to go to school. When he was 14 years old, his mother sent him to work for a tailor to learn to make clothes. Andrew worked hard. He opened his own tailoring business in the eastern part of the state of Tennessee. When he was 18, he married. His wife, Eliza, taught him to read and write.
Andrew became active in politics. At the age of 21, he was elected to the town council. 2 years later, he became mayor of the town. At 35, he won a seat in Congress in Washington. Next, he became governor of Tennessee. Then the state made him one of its two senators. The poor tailor boy was a success.
Andrew Johnson was a member of the Democratic Party. In the presidential election of 1860, he supported his party's candidate, not the candidate of the Republican Party, Abraham Lincoln. But Lincoln won the election, and, as a result, Southern states carried out their earlier threat. They began leaving the Union to form their own nation. Johnson opposed this secession. He believed the South should remain part of the United States. He decided he had no choice but to support the Republican president. Most of the other citizens in Tennessee disagreed with him. They decided to leave the Union. Andrew Johnson had to flee his home to save his life. He returned only after Union forces took control of Tennessee and made him military governor.
President Lincoln noticed the man from Tennessee who supported the Union over the opposition of others. In 1864, Lincoln decided to run for re-election. He chose Johnson to be his vice presidential candidate. Lincoln hoped Johnson would win the support of Union-loving Democrats. He hoped Johnson would help heal the wounds between North and South. Now, Lincoln was dead, and Johnson was president. It was up to this little-known former tailor to make the decisions on Reconstruction, on rebuilding the Union. Johnson, not Lincoln, would decide if Reconstruction would be easy or hard. Johnson would choose if the North would punish the defeated rebel states or be merciful to them.
The radicals of Lincoln's Republican Party wanted severe Reconstruction. They said the South was a defeated enemy. They demanded strong punishment for all Southerners who took part in the rebellion. These radicals had disliked Lincoln's plans for Reconstruction. They felt he was too weak. Now, they hoped Johnson would share their ideas. They urged him to call a special session of Congress to pass strong legislation against the South. The radicals had reason to believe the new president agreed with them. He had called the rebels traitors. He had demanded strong action against them when the war ended. "The time has come," Johnson had said, "when the American people should understand what crime is, and that it should be punished."
But Andrew Johnson surprised the radicals. He did not call the special session of Congress. Instead, he announced his own program for the Southern states. Johnson declared a pardon for all former Confederates who promised to support the Union and obey laws against slavery. Then he permitted former officials of the Confederacy to run for office in their states' new elections. Many of these former rebels were elected. The radical Republicans were angry. They saw these elections as proof that the South had not really changed. They accused Johnson of being too soft. They urged him to punish the rebels. One radical newspaper wrote, "There is only one sure and safe policy for the immediate future. The North must remain the dictator of the Republic until the spirit of the North shall become the spirit of the whole country. The South's treason is still unpunished. Southerners cannot be trusted."
The radicals also worried about what would happen to the recently freed slaves. They said the new state governments of the South would not treat blacks as free and equal citizens. As proof, they pointed to new laws the Southern legislatures passed. For example, the state legislature in Mississippi said no black person could rent farmland. It said a black person needed special permission to work at any job except farming. Mississippi also passed a law saying a black person could be forced to work for a white man, usually his former owner, if he had no other job. Another way the state governments in the South acted against blacks was by refusing to give them the right to vote.
The radical Republicans decided that President Johnson's Reconstruction program must be stopped. They began working to get control of Congress, to pass their own program. Only by gaining political power could they punish the South and guarantee full political rights to former slaves. The radicals tried to take control in two ways. First, they refused to let many of the recently elected Southern congressmen take their seats when Congress opened. Then they formed their own Joint Committee on Reconstruction. This committee, not the Senate or the House of Representatives, would make many of the decisions about Reconstruction.
Radical lawmakers took other steps to seize control of Reconstruction efforts in the South. Congress had established a government agency to take care of black refugees in the South. The agency gave food and clothing to former slaves who had no food, money, or jobs. It began to teach them to read and write. Republicans in Congress moved to extend the life of the agency and increase its powers. They passed a bill and sent it to the White House for the president's approval. President Johnson vetoed the bill. He said it would create false hopes among former slaves. He also said it was unconstitutional. The radicals tried to overturn Johnson's veto. However, they failed to get the necessary votes.
Congress passed several other bills giving the federal government power to protect the rights of blacks in the southern states. President Johnson vetoed these bills, too. He said they interfered with the rights of the states. These defeats made the radicals even more angry. Their newspapers began a steady attack against the president and his policy toward the South. Some even accused him of treason.
Many Americans agreed with this criticism of President Johnson. They gave the radicals a big victory in congressional elections of 1866. Radical leaders gained the power to pass any bill they wished, even over the president's veto. And they wasted no time doing just that. Time after time, they voted to overturn Andrew Johnson's vetoes. The atmosphere in Washington became very tense. Relations between Congress and the White House sank to their lowest level in history. The political skies darkened. Soon, the storm broke. The radicals tried something that had never been tried before. They tried to remove the president from office. The conflict between the radicals and Andrew Johnson would provide some of the most historic and intense moments in American history. That will be our story in the next program of The Making of a Nation.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.